Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Dedicated to Henry Farman. In the year of the primal form, the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and horse, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an olive skin from the heart of an olive tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigorous steam, he harnessed the lightning for hire, he drove the celestial team, and man was the lord.
Good evening, good afternoon, good whatever, good morning, good, I don't know, good whomever, however I may find you. This is Alan Averill, this is Agitators Anonymous. Now this episode was recorded and released a while ago on my Patreon, which is patreon.com/AlanAverill, A-V-E-R-I-L-L, the man who shall conquer in April. There you go, Norman surname. Exactly. Well, anyway, over on the Patreon, there's demos, there's rehearsals, there's conversations, there's discussing books, all sorts of things, and also bonus podcasts and things that come out long before they come out on the normal podcast. Go and have a look if you want. This is a very in-depth discussion and look at the recording process, what goes into making an album, what goes into the day-to-day, how you plan, how you project, also a lot of stuff about how I look at lyric writing, rhythmic structures, approaching various things, my attitude on what I'm focused on and definitely what I'm not focused on, all that kind of thing. I understand that throughout all of the episodes, sometimes my ramblings on politics, culture, my daft take on some things, my ironic, sarcastic black humor, my gallows humor, leave some people on the shore because they are fans of Primordial, they are fans of Dread Sovereign or April Men or whatever other music I've made, and they want to know specific things about music. I've realized that there are several different kinds of podcasts. There are the ones that are super in-depth with minute detail, those sort of true crime kind of things. And then there's the rambles and whatever else. Mine takes on the modality of rambling probably more often than some people like, because I think some people would like to know very specific things about drum recording and that kind of thing. Now, that wasn't originally my intention in doing a podcast, to make it only about those things, because that's not really what interests me. In fact, you know, back in the day when I would have picked up a magazine, if a band started off telling me about how much they've progressed as a musician and the this, that, and the other, I would just instantly turn off. I don't care which thrash band all of a sudden started wearing a Rush t-shirt and decided they could play. It was of no interest at all to me. I wanted to know more about the lyrics. I wanted to know more about the person. I wanted to know more about the atmospherics, the aesthetics, all that kind of thing. And then gradually, of course, as black metal took over, you wanted to know all about their worldview or whatever else. Certainly, I didn't care what the bass amp combo was, but I do understand that for a lot of people, that's something they're really interested in. So this podcast is just a very in-depth ramble about recording techniques, about approaches. It may not surprise anybody to discover that Irish people kind of fly by the seat of their pants when it comes to organization. We aren't the most, structured, organized people. I think I could say that as a sort of national trait without getting into too much trouble. We tend to leave a certain percentage of things to chance, to fortune, to the weird, to fate, to whatever you want to call it. And that's just sort of our way, I think, as a people. Maybe younger people and younger generations of musicians are different, but certainly this was the way Primordial always left a certain element to chance. And that's part of trusting in yourself as a musician. But that's what I went on to talk about. So www.hatecouture616.com. Use the promo code Alan and you'll get free shipping. Loads of hateful yet tasteful apparel, nasty t-shirts, grim stuff about tyrants and serial killers. Go and have a look. Also, second one, www.metalblade.com. If you're in North America, put in the promo code AA podcast and you will get 10% off. So I don't know if you want to go and buy that new Cannibal Corpse album, Dread Sovereign, Primordial, Fate's Warning, 6 Feet Under, I don't know. So many things to choose from for over the last 40 years. Go and take a look. All right, let's get into it. This is, as I said, and originally this appeared on my Patreon. Lots of things like that go up there. But this one I felt was maybe too good to sort of not throw it out there to the wider audience. So here we go. Let's get into it. The recording process. So I just thought I'd make a little podcast about recording, about the recording process, maybe a day in the life within the studio that goes into making a record. Some of the things that have changed over the years from back in the day to now. Fundamentally, they are more or less the same for a band like Primordial, who still go into the studio. But much of the technology has changed in that many bands now record remotely, as in record their files themselves, send them to each other, mix independently. So it's very much changed since the 80s and the 90s, that's for sure. But I just thought I'd do maybe a little ramble across the process. How you begin and how you add the layers, all that kind of thing. As a listener, maybe there are things about it that you've never thought about before or never realized. So for Primordial, usually we are, I would say, 60 to 70% ready with the songwriting. If an album has, let's say for argument's sake, 8 songs, usually we have 5 or 6, maybe 6, more or less 80%, 90% ready. And then bones of 1 or 2 others. And very often we write in the studio. We'll come in early in the morning, lay out the ideas, put them together. I think that it's important as a musician to trust in your instinct, to trust in your gut a bit. And we were never one of those bands that rehearsed songs to the nth degree. I know of bands, peers and friends who make 20 different demos of songs. They have them minutely worked out and they have tiny harmonic differences, backing vocal differences worked out, and those are huge debating issues. Primordial never really did that. There's a certain sort of reckless trusting in your instinct that goes into making a Primordial album that I think is very important. And I also like the idea personally of having to work on the spot, having to cope with adversity. For example, being asked an hour before you finish your vocals for something like, okay, you need to finish this at 8 p.m. because we have a deadline. You have an hour to finish these lyrics. You need to get this right within the first 1, 2, 3 takes. For me, that's very important. And it galvanizes my creative instincts. Having too much time to think about things, I think, is the wrong way to make heavy metal. I think heavy metal rock music should be instinctual. I don't think you should be mixing and remixing and mixing down an album 6, 7, 8, 9 months after you've recorded it, endlessly going back, tinkering with things. That's not my idea of how it should work at all. I think you need to go for it, push it, be reckless, trust your instinct and just roll with it. Of course, you need to be, rehearsed. You need to be or at least have a very focused idea of what you want to do. Going in with no plan whatsoever doesn't make any sense. But for me, I'll have lyrics written all different places and I'll begin to piece them together. If it's Dread Sovereign, I'll have my riffs in my head. I'll write them down. I write them down numerically in relation to the notes. Sometimes I'm thinking about songwriting, sitting on a train, and I'll write down the notes with numbers. I won't have the guitar. I think of the note. I think of the, I suppose, pitch it in my head. And then think of the combination of notes and I'll just write them down. Maybe an odd way to do it, but everybody has their odd ways of making a record, their little idiosyncrasies, the things that they do to make it come to its conclusion, to fruition, to creativity. And sometimes it's true that if you are traditionally a lyric writer or a singer, it's not very often that I would sing harmonies into my phone, but it has been known here and there. But very often I just write lyrics independently. I have books and books of lyrics all over the place. And sometimes I pick out an idea from 2002 and go, there's a nice two lines. I wonder, could I write around them and write something now? And how does that make sense now, 10, 15 years later? Very similar to, I think, people who write riffs on the guitar. They go through old discs. Old mini disc was a popular thing for a while. They go through old cassette recorders and they just pick out riffs. Certainly, I have old phones with lots and lots of riffs on them. Sometimes, as I said, I might think of a riff, pick up the guitar, play it, and straight away just put the phone in front of the guitar, record onto voice memo, and 20, 30, 40 little 30-second, one-minute bits later. And then when it comes around to songwriting, you sift through them and think, oh, that's not such a bad riff. Let's try that out. But it's very important for me that that trial and error process has to be done in a rehearsal room. It has to be done in person. Of course, this is amplified, my feelings on this and the situation that we're in now with lockdown and the pandemic, where it feels to me like we're being corralled into some sort of anti-human process of living, which I'm against, but when it comes to making music, I think it's very important to keep the humanity in making music, which means standing in a room with the people in your band arguing about, no, this riff must go here and how about this, and the energy that can only be created from people being in that room together, whether it's a gig or whether it's recording or whether it's rehearsing, that has to be fundamentally right at the heart of making music to me. I don't see or won't take part in writing remotely or trading files or anything like this. So anyway, the process of making an album for Primordial, we rehearse, you know, we'd usually start 6 to 9 months before. Let's say you pick a month in the year, let's say a March, and you say, okay, by October, we're going to have enough songs for an album. And then that's something to work towards. So you'll source a studio, you'll source an engineer, you'll just start discussing with people. We're projecting to do this in 6 or 7 or 8 months. You have to fix a release date within the schedule of the label. The label has a lot of records to release. You can't just make the record and give it to them and go, hey, you need to release this in 3 months, because it's a 3-month process from handing over the final masters to the release date in theory, which includes pressing, promotion, all that kind of thing. But very often they have a packed and tight release schedule. So you have to book your place within that, sometimes a year in advance. So you have to stick to deadlines. You can't just kind of wing it and go, we just made this and can you release this now? And it doesn't work like that. So let's say we, in February, March, begin to think about, okay, let's think about October, November. And that gives you something to work towards. And like I said, you start to source and look at studios. Do you go abroad? Do you stay at home? There's very great rewards or very many positive things to be said for finding a studio that is away from where you live so you can fully concentrate on what you're doing. i.e. you don't go home for your dinner, you don't go to your local pub, you can get a bit of, you can get time away from your normal life to be able to concentrate on what you're doing. But of course, the problem with that is that you need to take time off work, which then means you have less time later in the year for maybe playing gigs or going on tour. So it's all a kind of question of mundane give and take, very banal give and take. And there's nothing you can really do about that. If you take 2 weeks off your, let's say 10 working days off your schedule to record an album, that's 10 days. You might not be able to play festivals where you do get paid, in theory. So again, there's a lot of positives to be said for finding a studio somewhere else. And then again, also with time constraints, sometimes maybe you need to pick a studio in the city you're from and just record over weekends. Bring what you have home, think about it, mull it over, go back over it and come back the next weekend. And literally just do Friday evening, Saturday, Sunday, Friday evening, Saturday, Sunday. It's not ideal, but the idea that musicians had the time to do all those things is something that pretty much belongs in the past. Unless, of course, you have your own home studio, you have your own Pro Tools setup that you're just using with an Apple Mac or whatever you're using. This is, of course, possible if you're one of those bands that just trade files, cuts and paste things, adds things in. The biggest problem is recording drums. You can't really do that the same way without actually going into a drum room and setting up some mics. I mean, of course, you can trigger something. You could play an electronic kit and somebody could just send over the files. Then you add your part sitting in front of your screen. Many bands do this because there's so little money available from the industry for recording because there's no physical sales anymore, all this kind of stuff. So the collapse of the music industry in terms of physical sales has a knock-on effect into how much money labels are willing to spend on bands recording. You get your money from the label, in theory, and it's up to you what you spend it on. If they give you €10,000 and you spend €1,000, you get to keep 9, in theory. But that means you've got to make a proper sounding record for €1,000, which, if you're going to record proper big open sounding drums and want to go to a proper studios, is impossible. Because of course you need to pay engineers, you need to pay mastering, all these kind of things. So it's a strange catch-22 of a situation where you want your album to sound the best it possibly can, but at the same time you are aware of the constraints as regards to the budget, and the fact that the reality of making any royalties is pretty difficult or an insignificant consideration after making almost 20 albums. The amount of money I've made out of royalties, actually, i.e. breaking even and making money, is almost negligible, almost minimal. So that's not really a consideration when you go into recording. You try and do the best you can with the budget that you have, which very often for most bands means spending everything that they're given. So with Primordial, like I said, we're usually about 2/3 to 3/4 prepared. And what we would do is, let's say the studio's in Dublin. Maybe the evening before you go to the studio, you kind of prep it a bit. You look around. You visited maybe once or twice before, done a few recons, looked at the outboard gear, which is all the effects units. You look at what the studio has to offer in terms of a live room. Is it live? Is it dead? How is the sound of drums? What kind of amps do they have? What kind of pedals do they have? Now, the reality is that most outboard sound effects units, which were the processors through which the sound went or were put through, are all internal now. They're all internal to, and they're all basically apps, so to say. They're all internalized within the computer that you're using. So in the olden days, you would have used analog tape reel, which now costs over €1,000 for like a 14-minute reel, I think, which is pretty impractical to try and buy. We used to record on that in the 90s. But the idea that you used to record in an analog way, if you think about analog is vinyl, digital is CD, i.e. the sound wave, in the analog sound wave is curved, whereas if you think about it, the digital sound wave is pixelated. Now, that's a very simple way of explaining it. But I mean, of course, tiny, tiny, tiny digital, audio pixelation, but it's still a digital process. The analog process is something quite different. So you would have used an analog desk, proper mixing faders, each with a channel, very traditional, whereas now all of this is contained just in Pro Tools just on a computer, similar to the garage band that I'm recording this into. So many people, many studios now are quite bare. They don't have the huge old desk. They don't really need it. But of course, the sound of a 1970s rock record, I would argue, is very difficult to replicate in a small space in a digital environment. It's a sort of a lost art, that Martin Birch 1980 huge open drum sound, the sound of your everything from your Iron Maiden to your Fleetwood Macs, to your Led Zeppelins to whatever. This is a very hard, if not impossible, skill to replicate in the modern day. And also bands back then were spending a lot of money on records. Some were, some weren't, but there was skill, there was invention. You were placing drums in interesting rooms, trying to get different ambient sounds and that kind of thing. This is a sort of a lost art. Anyway, well, I feel it is. Anyway, so we go into the studio, let's say the morning of the first day, you set up the drums, you've tried to source the best drum kit that you possibly can. I always think of something that Mags from Academy used to say to me. He used to say, you can't polish a turd, which means basically, if you're using awful instruments, awful gear, awful equipment, and you perform awfully, you can't really polish those things up entirely. Now, of course, you can change guitar sounds now internally. You can reamp, they call it, which is just change the guitar tones. But a bad snare sounds like a bad snare, unless, of course, you sample a snare online, etc., etc. But rather than fix everything at the end, it's better to start off with the best signal you can. So you try and find or source the best possible drum kit. It's quite the art to setting things up. Sometimes I've known engineers who make almost like a tent, a teepee around the drums in a big room to capture the sound. They're making specific kind of extra tubes around the bass drum to capture the ambient sound, all of this kind of thing. And Primordial doesn't fuck around. We don't mess around with the drums, really. Usually Simon is bang on the money with his takes. And unless we are writing something, it's in the process where, you know, you're kind of going, I'm not sure about the last section of that song. Most of the drums will be first or second takes. So if the band is locked into having all of the songs written, then, or written within the first, say, you might write the song, put the finishing touches that morning to the riff, to the idea. Simon is usually done within 20 takes, I would say, usually within 2 days. So you'd spend most of the first day getting the first two takes right, checking all the sounds of the bass drum, the snare. Are you separating the different signals? You know, tom 1, tom 2, tom 3, are they separate? Personally, I like things to bleed over a little bit. I'm not into the idea of separating every tone. I think the drums should be the drums, and I like a lot of ambient room noise, and I like lots of noise, mistakes. Tone with Dread Sovereign, I let the bass amp bleed into the drum mics. This doesn't bother me at all. It should sound like a really loud band playing in a room, which is what Dread Sovereign is. There's no playing through the desk. There's no playing through small amps. You're playing through a proper big stack, which is a big fuck off amp. I wouldn't do it any other way. Primordial is a little bit different because it's more layered and it's more, well, let's say, musically articulate, musically sophisticated in a sense. So that first day, everyone plays together in the same room or the same space at the same time. You record the drums, you'll do what's called a scratch bass and a scratch guitar, which is, they're like guide guitars, guide bass, where you record along with the intention of going back over them to fix the signal. But very often, if they're good enough, they stay. Definitely for Dread Sovereign, my ambition is to do as little overdubbing as possible. So if I'm playing 80, 90% of that song in the pocket, then I'll just leave it. I don't care about the mistakes. Obviously, you've got to be in tune and stuff. But I'll never play the same song on the bass twice, ever. I'll always add in notes, scrapes, noises. I'll never pick it the same way. And I like that. I've no interest in it being formulaic or always having the same feel. But with Primordial, sometimes 30, 40% of that first bass take might be kept. And Paul might drop in a few things where the tempo changes. But if it's done correctly, it might stay. With the guitars, it's less likely that they'll stay because you're kind of sketching ideas out. You haven't coloured in the palette yet. They're a bit black and white. But that said, if the tone you get off straight away is good, I think it's a good idea to, you know, try and while the drums are being done to get that good guitar tone and not trust in reamping, trust in fixing it. Trust in fixing as little as possible is my kind of motto, really. Try and get things as good as they are right out of the gate, because then it gives you less headaches when inevitably something breaks down the line or you lose a day or two to something shutting down, something that needs replacing. That's just, you always factor in something fucking up or, I don't know, somebody's car breaks down and they can't get into the studio that day to record this or that or the other. You should always have a second and third thing prepared. So if you're thinking, okay, on day three we start bass, who knows? Maybe the bass amp doesn't work. You should, I mean, personally, I would always have a few vocal things that I think I could work out without needing the full song structure in place. You need to have second, third arrangements in your head. You also need to maybe map out how you're going to spend your time. If you've got, say, To the Nameless Dead was made in 10 or 11, 12 days total, which is very quick. You kind of, if you're rushing ahead and going for it, just keep going. You don't need to dawdle for a day or two. It's not, I don't think you do. Just keep forging ahead. Keep trusting your instinct. Keep going for it. If you've got a bit more time, 20 days, it's good to make almost like a calendar projection of where you'd like to be. On the seventh day, we want to be here, et cetera, et cetera. And try as best as you can to stick to it. Personally, I'm a sort of night owl. I like working at night. This doesn't suit other people. So you try and have that division of labor, which says, okay, you want to work at 10 a.m., then do the guitar at 10 a.m. I'll come in at 4 and start doing vocals. Personally, I like 1, 2, 3 hours of really concentrated work where you're really in the zone, so to say, which is, sounds like a cliche, but true, where you're really up for it. And you can't do that if you're tired, not for singing. It doesn't work like that. So you definitely mark in your calendar, okay, I think from 4 to 7, we're going to do it. A lot of engineers don't mind going late at night. Some don't. They want their evenings, etc., etc. But you should be kind of clear about this stuff before, because it can cause kind of arguments and that kind of thing. Personally, I always, being a night owl, I'm not going to be up at 9 or 10 in the morning singing. If you're tired, your voice sounds tired. Sing when you're up for it. And for me, that means in the evening. But, you know, you've got to make compromises with that. So you record these scratch bass and scratch guitar. So everything is done live. A lot of bands cut and paste drums. They play to a metronome, which is tick, 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 which keep, you know, a metronomic clock, which keeps, you know, you play with headphones on for the drums and it keeps you in time. We never did that, ever. No Primordial album is made to a metronome. No Dread Sovereign album is made to a metronome. I've never played the bass to a metronome. I have no interest in that. If it rolls a little bit in the timing, then that's how it is. That's how heavy metal was. And if it's good enough for Venom and the Misfits, then it certainly doesn't bother me. I don't care. So I've never tried to apply too many things like that. In fact, I just, to be honest, trying to make things too perfect, like making tempo maps and all this kind of thing, it just irritates me. And I'm A, probably too lazy, but B, definitely feel that it has no place in rock and roll. That's how I feel. Okay, sure, if you're playing in a super technical band, then totally I understand, but not for me. So you maybe roll on to starting doing bass, I'd say, on the start of the third day. If you're on a roll, you could get all of the bass done in one day. I don't see any reason why not. You go back over the scratch bits and you go, oh, this is pretty good. We could keep that. You drop in, which means that you're just recording over small little sections, just replacing bits. But if the feel is right, just leave it. And then the main body of work is the guitars. This is often very trial and error. If a song is written by guitarist A, very often guitarist B will leave guitarist A to play all the parts. It depends how rehearsed you are. If you're a thrash band and you're going back and forth with different solos, okay, or you're all writing together. But very often many bands leave the idea to, well, this is your song, so you play most of the parts. This can lead to its own problems, I think. I think, personally, the best heavy metal records have, you know, Denner Sherman, Hanneman King, Holt Hunolt, K.K. Downing, Tipton. You know, they have different guitar tones, and this is something that's been lost over the years. 70s and 80s bands, whether it's Voivod, Creator, Celtic Frost, Possessed, think of those bands. As soon as you hear them, their tone, you can tell Tom G. Warrior's feedback, you know it's Celtic Frost. And that is because they were all playing through different amps, different setups, different guitars. It was virgin territory. And now, very much, you're playing, people aren't playing through amps, they're playing straight into the computer, straight into the processor, straight into, there's no amps involved. And they're just picking guitar sounds off basically lists of, we could call them guitar amp apps, whatever you want to say it. And it doesn't have the same feel. It's not the same as a big dirty amp sitting in the corner, a 1977 Marshall head with an old cab and whatever strange guitar you're using. And that's important. So we never use, we never just play into Pro Tools. We try and have amps and feedback and noise, and that you can feel the heat off a band playing. Dread Sovereign, for example, is very much like this. Everything is bleeding into everything. Is all of us playing in a room. There has to be this reckless, devil-may-care energy to what we're doing, which I think we sort of capture. Primordial is a little bit less devil-may-care, but it's still got that feeling in it, which is, I think it's partly a kind of Irish way that we're a bit sort of reckless and fly by the seat of our pants sometimes. But definitely the old guitar tones are something that I would really aspire to. Some bands layer the guitar three, four, five, six times with the rhythm guitars. I don't see any need to do that, because I think that what that means then is that the guitar is taking up almost all of the dynamic range. So if you're recording six layers of rhythm guitar and then you wonder why your drums sound small, the reason is because you've got six layers of rhythm guitar. I think you should have two layers either side, two rhythms and the solos or harmonies in the middle. I would even peel back the distortion, personally. I prefer the bass taking up the bottom end. I always have bass distortion. I would always consider it part of even a little grind in Primordial, but definitely Dread Sovereign, it's hard Motorhead Lemmy style distortion. So the guitar doesn't need to be that heavy. They don't need to fight each other. I rather have the bass without a doubt underpinning the whole sound. It has to be really, really eminent in the sound. That's what I like personally. Motorhead 1980 kind of style, old Man of War, that kind of thing. So I don't need a huge guitar sound, and I think that's one of the things that's very evident in modern heavy metal of the last 20 years, is a very compressed, huge dynamic range guitar tone, which just to me takes up far too much space. And then you have, so that means you have to have very clicky, pointed drums poking out through that, because the guitar is just taking up too much dynamic range. This is my personal choice. I prefer less distortion, less gain, richer guitar tones, and to definitely try as hard as possible to have both rhythm guitars on either side very, very different tones. Try and have guitar players not playing through the same amp and not playing through the same guitar, not just plugging into each other's pedals and sounds. Try and have completely different tones. That's what I would aspire to. When you think about Hell Awaits or something, you know who's Hanneman, you know who's King. They're very different guitar tones. And that, I think, is, again, a kind of a lost art, but I think is absolutely essential. At least I feel it's sonically essential. It's a separation of instruments. The band has to sound like a band playing, warts and all, mistakes and everything, feedback. But the separation of instruments and tones is very, very important. So getting the best, richest tone to begin with. So playing the most expensive guitar through the, maybe not necessarily the most expensive, but definitely having a very distinctive tone. Like Dread Sovereign rehearses loud, and I would pay a lot of attention to what I want things to sound like. I won't play rehearsal through a tiny little amp and not bother with the pedals just to play. So I'm always thinking about the tone and the sound. And so you have to have a very kind of strong focus about the definition of the sound that you want. And I think with Primordial, because many of the chords are not bar chords, they're not downstroke, they're not palm muted, which is just guitar phrases for, it's a very unheavy metal way of playing heavy metal because they're full open chords. And that is a very different way of playing heavy metal. So you need a very specific tone and sound. If it's too brutal, too heavy, you won't hear the richness in the notes. So that means you have to have less distortion, in my opinion. Because the heavier you try and make it, the more rough it tends to be and the less you hear the notes. But of course, sometimes roughness is entirely part of the game as well. So you're sort of living on your instinct with each song. You're living with your impulses. And to me, the impulses must be that it has to sound like a band playing in a room together. It has to sound vital, has to sound energetic. It has to sound like you absolutely mean it with complete conviction. So therefore, the diction of the vocals is highly important. The vocals should never just sound like a noise over the top to me. You have to understand every word without a lyric sheet. You must understand the intent. Even if you don't understand the English, you have to know exactly what the mood is. That's always been something that's ultra important to me. It's something you learn from 60s, 70s and 80s singers, from the Dios, from the Paul Rodgers, from the Phil Moggs, from the Phil Lynott's, is diction is absolute. And so I never cloud the vocals in too much reverb. I never put them too far back. They have to kind of sit within the music, but also a little bit on top. Very often a very black metal trait of the 1990s was to bury the vocals behind the music. It's not really my style. Like I said, I'd rather have the two guitars panned very hard left and right with different tones, the bass taken up the middle with some heaviness, some meatiness, some distortion, and the vocals sitting just on top of that, and a very, very open, very 1980, 1977 style drum sound. That's my perfect idea. And everything to have a richness of tone that doesn't require much mixing. It sits in really well together. That's what I would like. And you've got to mix quickly. You can't spend ages going back and back and back and over it. So then maybe let's say after you take a little bit longer. You probably need 5 days, 4 or 5 days for the guitar. This is all in an ideal situation. Don't forget, we made To the Nameless Dead, recorded, mixed in about 10 and a half, 11 days. 6 out, 5 back in for the mix. But, you know, if you have 2 weeks, sometimes you have 3 days. So, you know, Dread Sovereign and Made for Doom, the bell tolls in 2 days, where you just play live, plug in, don't mix, don't spend a lot of time mixing. But what you have to do then is not drag the arse, as they say, out of the guitars. Try and be focused. You know, it's a good idea to, I think, record some alternate harmonies, but not too many, because it'll be a nightmare to mix. You just get super distracted by... if you may have too many choices, I think, when you're mixing, then that can become very distracting. Sometimes it's better to not just record every idea that you have, because once it comes to, like I said, mixing, and you're working under the clock, you're then thinking, oh, what does this sound better or that sound better? It's the same with vocals. I'll record, if I'm rolling on a good chorus, I'll do 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 layers of vocals, but they're harmonies or they're backups. If a verse feels good and you do it in one take, you just leave it like that. Don't make 2, 3, 4 takes and then you're deliberating over, is this better than that better? If it sounds like the right thing, go with it, because it probably is. But if you give yourself 6 choices of or whatever as the end of a line, any one of them could make sense. So kind of what's the point in giving yourself 6 headaches? 1, maybe 2 choices, strong choices. So you're not asking the engineer, hey, can you just cut and paste whatever you think sounds best? That's not the best idea. And then you generally have, let's say, 70%, 80% of the body of guitars done. But you would leave the harmonies for after the vocals. So that, for me, that means generally when you're recording an album for a week and a half, a week, you're not doing anything. You're kind of just taking part, making notes, helping with the structures, trying to not be a pain in the arse. One of the things in the studio that's really important is to know when to not be there, because it can get pretty fraught. There can be a lot of fights, a lot of arguments. So sometimes to know when to walk away and sit in the local pub and read your book is very important, to not be around. Because sometimes, especially when you're younger, you think you need to throw your input into everything, throw your oar into everything. And in actuality, all you're doing is just sticking a stick between the spokes of the wheels that are going round. And that you have to trust each other to do your own job properly. So the guitar player has to trust the singer that they're going to do their job. Of course, you have input, you have, help along the way. But certainly for doing singing, I don't like to sing to the whole band just sitting on the couch reading magazines, kind of half listening, going, oh, I don't know about that. Because then what you're doing is you're literally auditioning. It becomes like a sort of heavy metal X Factor. And then everybody is pitching in going, well, what about this? I don't do that. I kind of refuse to do that in a way. Of course, it's fine with, as you get older, it's fine. You just let people get on with their jobs. But in the old days, it would have been singing to committee. And that caused so many arguments and so many fights. Because the reality is people just have to kind of trust your instinct. But if you have a band of people who all don't really trust each other and all want to impose their will on each other, this is what leads to huge fights and huge arguments. Sometimes you have an idea that's just completely over the top. There's probably many takes of songs that are sitting on cassettes from back in the day that were far too histrionic, far too over the top, lyrics that were just kind of ridiculous that thankfully the next morning I went, no, yeah, you're right, that was awful. Or ideas for leads or solos or things, and you go, ah, doesn't sound great. But the vocals, of course, are the thing that sets the kind of the ship off in a certain direction, the tone, the meaning, the intent very often. And so I write the lyrics, and I'm patently aware that lots of times in rehearsal nobody's paying attention to what the words are. So you do have to kind of be mindful of what is the tone of the song, what is the feeling of the song that's been written. Are you completely changing it with your lyrics? A good example of Primordial is the song Journey's End, or Bitter Harvest from Journey's End. Here's a song that Kieran meant as one thing that I took and wrote these quite horrific sort of nihilistic lyrics over. Now, it's still a cool song, but in my opinion, the lyrics don't really fit the tone of the music. And that was something you learn because we're 22 or 23 years old. You learn to try and fit things in together. And this is just something you accumulate knowledge as a musician. You begin to learn, like, okay, I have the feeling of what this song is. Wheeled Lightning to Split the Sun was written in about 45 minutes. Do you just have the two riffs? And I just thought, okay, I know what this song I think is trying to say. So you're trying to interpret each other's feelings. And that's just something you learn more and more as the time goes by. You learn certain little tricks and certain little, you have an idea. Like as Rome burns in the middle, the sing, sing, sing to the slaves. I have this idea of just rising crowd chant, almost like, something biblical. When the far off crowd is addressing, Pontius Pilate and Barabbas and all that kind of situation. That's what was in my head. Sing, sing. So you layer that 10, 15, 20 times and make it a rising noise. But these are ideas that, spontaneous ideas that just come to you, and you should probably roll with them if you trust yourself as a musician. So the singing, I don't fuck around. 2 days, maybe. I'd like it to be done in 2-3 days. 3 days, third day, maybe add the harmonies. But I've rattled out, say, for example, Dread Sovereign for Doom the Bell Tolls, the song 12 Bells Toll in Salem, blah, blah, blah. 12 Bells Toll in Salem is one take all the way through, straight through. I've done songs very often that are just one take all the way. Don't mess with them. Add a layer maybe to the chorus. That's it. I think Seed of Tyrants is a kind of a song like that. God's Old Snake, I remember writing the lyrics 30, 40 minutes before going into recording. Everybody being stressed at me going, you have what's your idea for the song? And you think to yourself, okay, I trust in myself. I know I want to write a song about Aleister Crowley. I have some words in my head. You just disappear for half an hour, 45 minutes, and it's done. You trust in yourself to do it, and then you're improvising sometimes while you're recording through words, through making amendments in your head as you're singing, trying to... It's very important also to... I think it's called onomatopoeia, I think, which is the sort of... the flow of the words, hard and soft consonants. There are certain words and like that you can't start singing a line with because you're rising up into it. So you have to learn how to the like these hard consonants. The is a will fit with the drum pattern, with the bass drum. And very often I will start with a hard consonant at the start of a bass drum rhythm, and then in my head I'm listening to it, and you land the note after maybe, you know, a certain section of the bar, you land on another hard consonant as opposed to a a-o-o kind of noise. And so that's my sort of style, not to be too regimented, but I do often, well, I am thinking about it within the structure of the rhythm of the, very much the bass and the drums. But I like it to be sometimes off-kilter or disorientating, or not to be the what you expect. A good example of this is Last Call on Exile Among the Ruins. Initially, the verses were too tightly locked in to the rhythm, and it didn't sound like me, so we unlocked the tightness, so to say, and went back to the drawing board, did a little bit again, and went across notes and made some curious, natural, to me, they're natural decisions. To other people, they would say, well, what? I don't understand why you put that in that section. To me, they're natural, but I like the kind of sometimes grating dissonance, or to not always follow what would be the normal rhythm. Like when we did With Lightning to Split the Sun, nobody really understood what I was trying to do with the verses, but in my head they made the most sense. But you trust with your instinct, and people are going, what, that doesn't make any sense, and you're just kind of going, just trust me, in an hour you'll see what I mean. And you know, over the years, as you learn, 75-80-90% of the time that's correct, or at least a version of correct, because let's be honest, you could do the singing 20 different times, 20 different ways, and it could all make sense, but you've got to settle on one or two. So you finish the singing, usually 2-3 days. Like I said, I don't fuck around. I don't want to be spending any longer than 3 days. It's just no. So then you add the guitar harmonies, which we're waiting for the vocals to fill in, which are kind of like the final little thing that you put in. Maybe acoustic guitar flourishes. Maybe there's a tiny bit of organ backing something up way back in the noise, or you know, little layers of backing vocals, and you're done. You try and think about the track list. Very often I'd prepare the cover or ideas for the cover 3-5 months in advance, because there's nothing worse than having an album recorded and everybody arguing about the artwork. It's a good idea sometimes to settle on the title. Like in my head right now, I have the title for the next record, and I'm already thinking about artwork, and we haven't even got any date for doing anything. That's just kind of how I like to sort of process all of that kind of stuff. And so you try and be as prepared as possible. And also at the same time, I would work on 3-5 potential different covers, because you anticipate that people won't like this or won't like that. And that's just sort of natural as well. Always be prepared, or have a second, third, fourth option, because like I said, very often something will break, something will shut down. Maybe you come in one day and the bass doesn't work and there's no other bass and you need to get it repaired. Be ready to get up there with another go, okay, I have a vocal idea, I want to do something, let's work on this. Or you know, somebody's car is broken down, okay, so we there's always something to do, so you're not sitting around doing nothing, because that's wasting money and it's wasting time and energy, which I just can't abide that at all. And like I said, there are times when you have to learn to not be there, because it'll just cause arguments, etc. They're life hacks, as they call them now, to recording. I think that bands should have a space then between recording and mixing to take the raw, the unmixed version home, listen to it, sit with it, think what you might want to do with the bass drum or the bass, and how you envisage the mix to be. Don't leave it too long. Maybe 2 weeks to digest, take it home, play it on different stereos, play it on different mediums, and then go back to somewhere else. Take ideally at least 3 days for the mix, but any more than that is a luxury. So 4-5 is great. Once you've broken the back of the first song, they all generally fall into place a bit after that. Once you've got the snare and the drum and the tom sound that you like, very much the drums then fall into place throughout everything. So that first song or two mixing is the most complicated. And you really need to be in a good headspace when you're mixing. Don't be tired, irritable, cranky. We had situations with one album where the internet connection wasn't working properly. So we were sending mixes across. It's also a good idea for not the whole band to be there. Certainly, I like being there personally. And I've mixed some albums just on my own, like Storm Before Calm, for example. But certain people have different ears. They hear things better. They hear mistakes. They hear electronic hum. They hear noises. Some people have a better overall feeling. But you've got to, within your band, determine who is that person. Because if you're all sitting there with all different ideas, then the power of suggestion is, do you think that bass sound is loud enough? Then you're listening to it. And then the question leads you to think it is or it isn't. So you've got to be able to try and step outside the situation and try and hear the overall tone and not just listen to what your part is. And so that situation was mixes were being sent, but the internet wasn't really working properly. People are coming back 4, 5, 6 hours later going, I don't like this. But of course, when you're mixing, you're working under the clock. So you're forging ahead with ideas and things, and you can't then go back to maybe not zero, but to one or two and then start again and move forward. You've got to keep moving. You've got to be in a good frame of mind. You've got to be, to be honest, upbeat. You've got to be focused. You've got to be in a good headspace. If you're irritable, tired, angry, annoyed, all of these things can cloud your judgment or your focus of what you're trying to do. So if you're like having heavy insomnia and getting up at 9 or 10 in the morning to try and mix, you're going to do it with a foggy head. So whatever environment or place you can manage to try and be in to be as relaxed as possible, you do it and then you push it. Now, very often I've been in mixing sessions that take 16, 20 hours a day, or you're doing it for over a day. And that's not ideal, but everybody is trying to make their name. Every engineer is trying to make their name and do it as well as possible to get further work. So very often you, whether you want to or not, you end up in a situation where you're overworking. But again, trusting in instincts and realizing that heavy metal isn't an exacting process. It's not mathematical. Sometimes the greatest albums have flaws. Gathering Wilderness has flaws that to us are more prominent than maybe to somebody who listens to it. But those flaws are what give it character, whether it's Bathory or Venom or everything. You could, fundamentally, there's flaws with all those things, but that's what errs to be human, so to speak. And I think those are very important. So listening to metal that sounds computerized, digitized, like a computer playing, it alienates me because I want to hear the dirt under the fingernails, the bloody knuckles, the mistakes, all this kind of stuff, because that's part of being human and being in a band. And, it's nothing is ever perfect. So at some stage, you have to just let go of a record. You have to let go of it, that some part of it might not be exactly as you wanted to. But in the fullness of time, over years, you'll come back to it and go, yeah, I understood why I let that go. So that's a very important thing to understand, is being able to just let go and go, okay, this album, this is what it is. Some things I like better in other albums, some things I prefer in other different records, but it is what it is. And it just captures you at a moment in your life, a moment in time, a moment in the band's lifetime. And that you don't need to constantly pick it over and over, and you don't need to keep going over those diary entries and editing them. Just at some stage, it's out. It's out there. It's done. And you'll find, probably, unless it's a really horrendous experience, that going back in years, you'll go, okay, yeah, I understood why we let that go. Then once everything is mixed, you just have to send it off to be mastered. Mastering is a strange thing. Now it's more important than it used to be, I think. You can change dynamic ranges and tones and textures in the mastering. And there used to be a sort of mastering loud war that was going on 15, 20 years ago. But a good mastering engineer is worth his weight or her weight in gold, who can maybe clean up a dynamic range or something that may be niggling with you, and make it punchy. You would just need some more middle. This mids need some more high mids. We need that. Can we bring out a bit of this? But you don't want to then use it to also remix. So you kind of want to have a very straight, simple message. I think it needs more middle, but not keep going back and forward with it. I've been in situations where I would admit that I've become very difficult about the mastering and made someone do it 3, 4, 5 times. But anyway, So then once it's mastered, it's sent to the label, and then you're just in the queue for the release. So there you go. Different platforms will compress the music differently. Obviously, if you buy the original on vinyl, it sounds a bit different to the CD. That's the two best formats to have it. Spotify has its own bit rate, which compresses the files. If you're listening on YouTube, the render might be different. So the records can sound a bit different depending on the platform. I would always say vinyl with it sounds the best. But you need, if you have a cheap record player, everything will sound cheap. Think about it in the sense that the cable between the stereo and the speakers is what transfers the sound. If those cables are cheap, your vinyl will sound probably a bit cheaper than it was intended to. So one of the first things I did when I had any money ever was buy a very expensive separate stereo. And that made all these records I was listening to for years sound very different. And that's when the beauty of Number of the Beast or all these records, Don't Break the Oath, really come into their own when you hear what a really great engineer has done. The Martin Birches, the Fleming Rasmussens have done in the 80s. And you go, oh my God, listening to Damage Incorporated through a proper stereo on the original vinyl. With, you know, the fresh needle and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so your medium, how you choose to listen to these things. If you listen to all your music on computer speakers, then, you know, all the engineering tricks in the world aren't going to change the fact that you're listening to music on computer speakers. I wouldn't recommend it. If you're listening on cheap headphones, things sound like they sound cheap. So again, the better medium you have for listening to the music, the bigger difference it makes. Now, I understand for most people, I'm talking about recording techniques, despite the fact that most people don't listen to music on proper stereos. So on some sense, you're putting all this effort into recording, and then you realize people are listening to on their Mac or whatever. What can we do? As musicians, you want to try and do the best you can with the songs that you have. Anyway, my friends, a 15-minute ramble on just the recording process. That's kind of how I approach it, sort of old-fashioned. Be focused, trust in your instincts. Try and get analog good signals, separate them, have hard tones, dynamic rich tones, and don't overthink things. And also know when to fuck off and not hassle everyone. All right, there you go, Nemtianka's Guide to Recording.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.